I'm going to record. So let's see. I don't have to ask you how you're going with the homeworks because you turned them all in. And we will by about Monday survey you as to when's a good time for a review session. And we were at the very end of talking about the sources of correlation. Covariance between characters as they evolve, and the two main sources were genetic covariances and selective covariances. And as I emphasized, you rarely hear about the latter, and that's a situation that should change. The genetic covariances, in principle, you can estimate by doing breeding experiments. You can have parent offspring or full sib designs, and you breed organisms, and you measure. You're basically measuring correlations and covariances between relatives. There's a whole set of methods for that. And if you do it in multiple characters, you will get genetic covariance estimates for estimates of genetic covariation and of phenotypic covariation. Between relatives for multiple traits, so you'll see how, to what extent, say, height and weight are genetically correlated. But if you want to understand selective correlations or selective covariances, and you don't have a total understanding of the ecology and of how those characters relate to the ecology, you won't have any immediate way of knowing whether natural selection wants to, using teleological language, wants to, say, have one character increase while the other one decreases, in spite of genetic covariances that might be saying the opposite. However, we have a research program we can imagine. It's very little talked about in the literature, but I think it's underlying what a lot of the things people are doing right now, looking at multiple characters distributed across phylogenies. And that is to use the information about how what the characters are in different species and the phylogeny in ways that I will show you in a moment, to make estimates of the actual changes in evolution, the covariation of the traits and their actual changes. When height increases, does weight increase? And then by comparing those to the genetic covariances, we can get an idea of the covariation of the selection pressures that sort of modifies what the genetics would quote, want you to do. So I think where we have to go from there is into this question of how do you infer the covariation of characters in their changes across the phylogeny. And there, a large set of methods that I'll be referring to this lecture, are comparative methods. Now, up till the late 1970s, biologists would talk about the comparative method. And it was actually an embarrassing literature because it had no methodology, no statistical methodology that made any sense, largely. And mostly what it was people saying, oh, you got to compare things with each other, and that's the comparative method. And if you ask them, well, tell me more about this comparative method, they had just told you everything they knew. And there was nothing further. Now I'm bad mouthing them, and I think that they might be able to defend themselves. But I think really up until the late 70s, nobody had sort of dealt with this issue or really sat down to figure out how you would do anything. And what happened in the 1970s were some biologists, mostly in Britain, we're trying to look at the way characters covaried in evolution. And they did so using the the classification system rather than a phylogeny. And they were sort of looking at, for example, how height and weight were correlated across a group of species, say, well, let's say length and weight across, or brain weight and body weight was a very popular one, across a set of species. And then people started saying, you know, I think there's a problem there. And the problem is that you're putting in multiple species within a single genus, and they're all showing up rather similar places on this graph of brain weight versus body weight. Maybe those are not to be treated as independent points. Maybe instead what you should do is plot points, one for each genus rather than one for each species. And they started debating that among themselves. And the projector just went. Yeah, we have the issue. There it is. It seemed I'm still missing my computer power cable, and I do have enough charge on the computer to do this lecture, but apparently the sleep mechanism has gotten, seeing that it's not plugged into the wall, it's decided to make the computer sleep quite frequently. So I'm going to have to keep waking it up. Now, they basically started arguing about class levels in the classification, which level to use to make a valid statistical inference of how brain weight was correlated with body weight. And there was a lot of uncertainty in the early 1980s about that, and I got involved in it and said, look, maybe you should do it using the phylogeny, and published a paper on this in 1985 in American Naturalist. And that paper almost didn't make it, because the reviewers, who were otherwise friendly, said, look, this is all very well, and it's a clever method and all that, but nobody has phylogenies. We have a classification system, but nobody has phylogenies. So you're putting forward an idealized method that people cannot use in practice. The editor decided in favor of publishing the paper, and I think if I had submitted a year or two earlier, it would not have been published, because the strength of that point, that we don't have phylogenies, would have been even stronger earlier. It was starting to weaken because molecular phylogenies were starting to arrive. And now, of course, the strength of that objection is trivial. People are using the phylogenies for this. We do have lots of molecular phylogenies. But the important point to emphasize here is, in spite of what I told you about, oh, there's ways of getting, using Brownian characters evolving under Brownian motion models to make an inference of the phylogeny, I'm not going to do that here. And even though quantitative characters can be rationalized as evolving according to something like a Brownian motion model, people can fight about that, I'm not going to say that we're going to use the quantitative characters to infer the phylogeny, but instead, the mode that we're in here is somebody out there has lots of molecules and they're creating phylogenies, they're inferring them, and we can make use of those phylogenies. And then we can take the molecular phylogenies, either single estimates of the phylogenies or clouds of them coming from bootstraps or clouds of them coming from Bayesian posteriors. And we can make inferences about what the characters are doing, assuming that those phylogenies are okay, assuming that those phylogenies are valid estimates. So that's the comparative method mode that we'll be in. We'll be looking at the issue of, given a tree, what are the characters doing? And I want to start out by, let's see, one thing I'm starting out is this figure looks awfully pale. I think
it might just be the lighting.
It could be the lighting. I don't think making my computer brighter actually helps.
Yeah.
Did it get brighter up there? No, I think it's only on the screen that it's brighter, so maybe I should make it as dim as I can on the screen. I think what I'm going to do, unfortunately, if you're taking notes, is, oh, no, that's, okay, well, you have some light, so. Is that any better? Or is it, these are like lights at the front of the room that are causing the trouble.
Yeah.
Well, the problem with that is I don't have a separate switch for those. I think what I have to do is that. That should turn off all the lights. Somebody could open a few shades to make this less dungeon-like in here. Yeah, that'll help you take notes and not to fall asleep as quickly. Okay, so let's consider just two characters, and let's for the moment not talk about Brownian motion, but just assume that they have two states, and we have some, let's even say a parsimony scheme, counting what those characters have done on a phylogeny. So here is a phylogeny, and here are the states of those characters in character one and in character two, and we're asking what they're doing on this phylogeny. Now, if we reconstruct the two, what I've shown here is each branch has two stripes in it, one of which will tell you what the first character is doing, and the second will tell you what the second character is doing. And if you do a parsimony reconstruction, what you find, well, these four here are in a different state, so we'll have them change in this branch right here. These four are also different in character two, we'll have them change here. Now, if you go across the tips and just take the tips analysis, which means counting each species separately and ignoring their relationship to each other, their genealogical relationship to each other, what you'll get is a little 2x2 table that will say six of them have this combination, white in character one and gray in character two. Four of them have gray in character one and white in character two. Do those two characters co-vary? Are they genuinely correlated? Well, that analysis would say pretty much yes. If you do a 2x2 chi-square on this, for example, you will, I haven't done it, but I think I have it in the book, I have what the analysis would be. And this is significant. And you say, okay, we have evidence that these two characters are covarying in their evolution. Well, not so quick, because if you look at not the states, but the changes along the branches, well, we have 19 branches in the tree in which neither state changes, one branch in the tree in which both characters change. So the question is, are there changes in non-independent? Well, it's this thing, and this thing is really not quite significant. This is a simple numerical example. And you can see that there is the issue of, well, should you do it this way or should you do it that way? Because it suggests that a phylogeny-aware analysis would possibly give you a different answer. The thing that it does not do is what this one does. This one treats each tip as an independent observation. And, of course, statistical methods that we use, largely, a great many methods are for cases where you have samples and they are draws out of an independent draws out of some distribution. That's what this is assuming. This one over here is not assuming that. So which analysis is it that we should do? Well, I'm going to go back now to continuous characters and show you a simulation, computer simulation. And that simulation says, well, let's suppose I have a phylogeny, and it's very simple-minded. It just has a single split, and then an 11-way split here and an 11-way split there. There are two clades. They show basically no structure within them, but there's this one big split that separates those two from each other. And suppose I take a simple Brownian motion model for character one, and another completely independent Brownian motion model for character two. So the truth is going to be that character one and character two are not in any way correlated. That's the truth. We computer simulate. And I was pretty careful. This is the example that's in the book. Whoops, wrong way. I was pretty careful to not do a whole bunch of simulations and then pick the one that made my point most effectively, I did the simulation once and took it as the example. Fortunately, it made my point. Okay, if you do that, and you have character one, which is on some kind of scale, doesn't matter what the scale is, nor character two, and you simply plot each tip according to the values you got in the simulation, you get this. Now, if you look at this collection of points, you might say, well, it looks to me as if there is a positive relationship between these, because when you get over here to the right, you tend to be in the top part. You get over here to the left, you tend to be in the bottom part. There's some kind of maybe linear relationship between them. If you put this into a regression program and you say, is the regression significantly different from zero? You'll be told that it is significantly different from zero. However, if you color in those points according to which clade they were in, you see a very different story. There are all the ones from the clade with black, and here are the ones in the clade with gray, and then your intuition should start to be suspicious, and you should start to say, wait a second. These are all the gray ones, these are all the black ones. What we're looking at is a difference between those two clades. We're not looking at any particular relationship of the evolution within each of those clades. Because if you look at these points and say, within this group, is there a correlation? It's not obvious. Within this group, is there a correlation? Well, maybe a slight negative one. So what signal there is within each group is certainly not telling you there's a positive relationship, but the differences between the groups are telling you that. Now, in order to get around that, we have to take into account the fact that this collection of points here is not drawn from a single distribution with independent, identically distributed. And that's not a surprise, because the whole point of a phylogeny is to be a diagram of how non-independent evolution was in different species. Anybody, you know, a monkey and us are not random draws from a distribution that also includes, you know, lizards and worms and oak trees and protists. We came off a tree and we're in a primate clade. So, with that hand waving, let's think about what we could do to get around those. And so what I'll do is I'll think about a phylogeny. Again, this comes from you imagine that this comes from lots and lots of molecular data, and it's pretty good. That is the true phylogeny. So let's imagine these are branch lengths. Here, this branch here would be estimated, if you were doing an unrooted tree analysis, that is a total length of 0.9, 0.7 of which is here, 0.2 of the 0.9 is there. And what I'm going to do is use the machinery that we saw with the Brownian motion that factored the tree into two species trees, and that did it by taking differences between neighbors on the tree. Here's a pair of neighbors, here's a pair of neighbors, A, B, and D, E. And having removed those and replaced them by an average, by a weighted average of these points, and having done the same over here, we would now have a tree in which this group and C are neighbors. So we could do a difference between those and replace this by a point. And then we'll have a point over here and a point over there, and we do a difference between those. So we can remove a difference here, here, and here, and here. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, there are 5 tips there, one fewer than the number of tips. And we're left by a single stalk that has a value that we're not going to use. Well, if you do that, yeah, here's the factorization that you get. You get This is a figure that is not in the notes, in the book. This was point 0.3 and point 0.1. When you removed those and then took an average, the average would be, now you got to remember how it's weighted. The weighting in the average was, let's see, did I put it over here? I did. I don't know if you can see it because I got the lights turned off. Basically, each branch is going to be weighted inversely by its own by the branch length. So we're going to weight this branch 1 over 0.1, and we're going to weight this branch 1 over 0.3, and we're going to divide through by the sum of the weights. So basically what that will come out is that there's three times as much weight on this branch as on that branch. The shorter branch is closer to the starting point, gives you a better picture of it. So it gets weighted more heavily. So whatever the character values were in A and B, we make a weighted average with B having three times as much weight. When we're finished doing that, if we divide by the square root of the sum of these things, so the square root of 0.3 plus 0.1, maybe I, just to remind you, should do this algebra on the board. Just a moment. And see if this pen works. So we have V1, V2, we have a value up here. We're going to take the difference between X1 and X2. That's going to be normally distributed with a mean of zero, with an expectation of zero, because in advance, when evolution is starting here, we have no idea whether X1 or X2 is going to turn out to be the higher value there. The expectation is the same, so the expectation of the difference is zero. And the variance of this will be V1 plus V2, or some multiple of it. There can be an overall rate for the character. And that's going to mean that if I take X1 minus X2 and divide by the standard deviation, which is square root of V1 plus V2, that's supposed to be normal zero with some variance, which is the variance for that of the Brownian motion for that character. And then what's left behind is going to be a branch, we'll draw it over here, whose value is the weighted average X1 times a weight which is 1 over its branch length, plus X2 times a weight which is 1 over its branch length, divided by the sum of those two weights. Now, I wrote it differently the other day. I said it was X1 V2 plus X2 V1 over V1 plus V2, which is kind of mysterious. Why is each one weighted by the branch length of the other? It's because they're really weighted by the inverses of their own branch lengths, and then the algebra works out trivially. And the weighted average is going to be, we'll call it X12, will be that. So that will be X12. Okay. Well, when we do that, I'm showing you here only what happens to the branch lengths. You have to add a bit of branch length when you work out all the variances and covariances. You have to add on an extra bit of branch length here, which is V1 V2 over V1 plus V2. And that too could be written in terms of reciprocals of these. So that's a little extra. So what we have here, we get the difference between these, we get a weighted average of them. Now you have two neighbors on the tree, A, B, and C, and you have to add a little extra branch length, which comes 0.3 times 0.1 over 0.3 plus 0.1, and it turns out to be 0.075. You do the same thing over here. You leave behind a single tip, and you add on a little extra supplementary branch length. In the symmetrical case, it's half the branch length, the 0.1. And you can then do the same operations on this, and finally the same operations on that. So what you have for a given character is a contrast between A and B, and it has variance proportional to 0.4, then you have a contrast between their weighted average and C. Then you have a contrast between D and E. This is all for the same tree. There are their variances. And then you have a contrast between the weighted average of ABC and the weighted average of DE, reminding us that looking back two steps, ABC are over here and DE over there. So the last one is the contrast through the root. And there you get those. Now, if you divide each contrast, Y1 through Y4, by its a thing proportional to its standard deviation. So square root of 0.4, square root of 0.975, square root of 0.2, and square root of 1.11666. You then get contrast, and what you can show is under a Brownian motion evolving up the tree, those standardized contrasts have the equal expectation, they all have expectation zero, they have equal variance, which will be some multiple like sigma squared for that character, but it will be the same for all the contrasts. So you have now made, out of five tips which were not independent, identically distributed, you've come up under the Brownian motion model with five values that are independent, identically distributed. And if you do that on the 22 species tree, the two groups of 11, you can do that. And you can deal with the multifurcation, the 11-way multifurcation, by putting in imaginary little bifurcations that have branch length zero. That will work out. And what you'll see is here are all the contrasts now. So now we're doing the contrasts in character one. We also do a same set of contrasts in character two using the values from character two. All the weights are the same. You're only really computing those for once and using them for all characters. So you can do the contrast in every character. And those should be, those pairs should be IID. And here they are computed for that tree. And what you see is no real signal. And by the way, they now have the scale because I'm making them, this will be the thing which is proportional to how many standard deviations they are. And basically, you don't see any evidence of a signal. You see a little bit from this. I've colored in all the contrasts according to which group they were in. All the black ones are in the black group and the gray ones are in the gray group, and there's one of them that's the single contrast between group one and group two. And that single contrast, which is a little outside the distribution maybe, marginally, is responsible for all that signal we saw of how character one was covariant with character two. When we were using the points as if they were IID, which they jolly well aren't. So given a phylogeny from molecular data, given a Brownian motion model, which is controversial, I mean, you will find people say, no, evolution doesn't do anything like that. The thing which people also use Ornstein-Uhlenbeck models for this, and it's a more complex issue, but you can do it. But outside of Brownian motion, of the idealized models, the Brownian motion and Ornstein-Uhlenbeck, you will find a lot of biologists who say, no, all this Brownian motion stuff is far too simple. Reality isn't like that. And I agree. That's always true when we're using models. However, their implied message is often, and therefore you should go away and stop doing that, not that I have a better model and I will present it to you and let's use that. Unless someone, critics are welcome to the event, but they must, there's a famous Gary Larson cartoon where an audience full of people are in this audience listening to a lecture, and everyone is carrying a duck under their arm, a barnyard duck. And then the caption was, suddenly Professor Hofnagel realized he had come to the lecture without his duck. Okay. My point is, if you come to the lecture and are a critic, you must bring your duck. You must bring an alternative model that is more realistic in your view, that is tractable. Okay. Otherwise, I will ignore you. Okay. So rant and rave. We'll. Okay. Can this all be used in practice? Here's an example. Jim Cheverud, who's done a lot of work in this area over the years, has a particular paper showing scaling of sexual dimorphism in body mass. So what he's going to do is plot the log, by the way, for characters that have a natural zero point, where zero is a meaningful value, as in length or weight, for example, a limit, where it's a limit, it is often advisable to take logarithms. Things will do better. The Brownian motion model will be better on the log scale than on the original. In fact, my general conclusion for characters like that is first take logs and do your analysis, and then only if you can rationalize some good reason to, if you want to go back to the original scale, you have to have a good reason for it. He did log female size. These are primates, many species of primates. Up here are human, orang, gorilla, I think this is chimpan, and maybe macaque, what does it say? Oh, no, mandrill, that's a baboon. And baboon-like thing. Okay, so here's lots and lots of species of primates. Here is the TIPS regression, that is individual species, because he's got the individual species labeled. They're not the contrast. Here is the specific regression, the TIPS regression. There it is. You fit those. But if you fit the contrast regression, well, in this case, it actually comes out fairly similar. And in the fact that they both, the equations are not significantly different from each other, I believe they have a significantly positive slope, but I don't see that I've written it down, that they wrote it in their figure capture. What this is the sexual dimorphism. What it is the log of the ratio of male to female sizes. So are bigger primates, do they have more sexual dimorphism? Well, this is trying to answer that question. Looks as if they do in this analysis. The whole field, which used to be concentrated on the TIPS regression, has now more or less switched over to the contrast. I should say that there is another method by Alan Graffin called the phylogenetic regression. It too uses a Brownian motion model. It uses likelihood expression. It does not take contrasts, but it takes into account the phylogenetic covariances. The two methods are great competitors with each other until finally somebody noticed something. Somebody noticed that if you did them, you always got identical results. In effect, the phylogenetic regression is an alternative computational strategy for doing exactly the same thing, for making exactly the same statistical inference. So it's just a matter of taste whether you want to use contrast explicitly or implicitly in the phylogenetic regression. Let's see what we've got here. Yeah. So it is, therefore, using these Brownian motion models, it is possible to do this kind of thing. And it's become a very large industry, really, in evolutionary biology. There are thousands of references to the basic papers here. And a lot of people, I have people come up to me and say, that must be your most cited paper. It actually is my third or fourth most cited paper, but they are seeing it cited a lot. Okay, and most people doing comparative biology are by now converted over to saying, yes, we've got to take the phylogeny into account. There's two people, I believe it was, I'm trying to remember, Steve Adolph was one, and I'm trying to remember if it was Ted Garland or Barry Sinervo was the other. They published a paper which was taking the same point and applying it in a particular area. And that is, there's a long tradition in fields like ecology of on physiology and so on, of two species regressions, where you have a phylogeny that has, in effect, two species. You basically take one species which lives in the desert and one species which lives in the tropics, and you list all sorts of characters of them, and you try to interpret them. And that's a sort of two-species regression. If you think about it, what it is, it's saying you've got one point and another point, let's fit a straight line. The problem is when you have only two points and fit a straight line, well, of course you can fit a line right through them. But its interpretation of its statistical significance is kind of dubious because you don't have any degrees of freedom left to test. You don't have anything to test what the noise was. So they wrote a paper that said you should stop doing these two species comparisons. They don't mean anything. And this caused some fuss because people were publishing lots of two species analyses. So recently I ran into Steve Edholf and I said, well, how's that paper doing? What's people's reaction to it? And he said, well, it's kind of embarrassing. He said, it's got a lot of attention. There recently was a symposium volume in which we were asked to write a recap of that paper 10 years later, saying, well, let's talk about that issue, he said. And it was really great that we got included in that volume. It meant that people are paying attention. On the other hand, all the other papers in the volume were two-species analyses. So, the two-species analysis is not dead yet, but should be. Okay. I want to mention a few other points. Two other, I think we have good time for this. One is the Brownian motion models and their cousins, the Orsini-Uhlenbeck models, are models in which change occurs continually in time. And that's fine, but the one thing it does not do is it does not do a good job of modeling punctuated processes. Now, there is this, I won't go through the whole story of punctuated equilibrium, but in the 1970s, about half a dozen people, most of them paleontologists, started saying, look, we think what happens to morphological characters in evolution is not continual change. But at the moment of speciation, there is a burst of change. One of those two species is founding a new species, going through some sort of bottleneck, and will have a burst of evolution as it possibly moves to a new adaptive peak. So they wanted to paint a picture that said at each speciation event, one of the species has a burst of change, the other not, the parent species not. And then after that, they settle down and optimum selection pulling into peaks takes over, and they essentially don't change. Well, if you try to model a punctuated equilibrium tree, I've done that here. Evolved a tree by birth-death process, and I assumed that there had been a burst of change. Here is, let's see if I can, here is a case. There is a speciation. One, the parent species isn't changing, it's as if it has a very small branch length. The descendant species has a burst of change. We'll just make a constant unit branch length here, so it's as if the branch length is one or something, that the branch length is some number. If I draw a tree that has that property, that at each fork, the descendant one has a branch of a certain length, which is the size of the amount of variance that would accumulate in that burst of evolution. And if I have the other have zero branch length, I can draw the tree, and here it is. What I've done, however, is put a little bit of a branch length on those parent species just so you can see that the branch is there, just so you can make sure what the tree is. Here is a tree. So you could say, well, a possible model of using Brownian motion models, you could possibly do that. If instead of taking the branch lengths that the molecular analysis gave you, you assume that the newer of the new species, if you somehow know which one is new, will have a burst of change and everybody else won't, that would be a tree that looked like this. And you might say, well, can we think about using trees that look like this to analyze punctuated processes under the assumption of some kind of punctuated equilibrium? And the answer is it's difficult. And it's difficult because what I assumed here was that I knew the entire tree of all descendant species of this line, where time is obviously going to the right, or accumulation of variance. And we, if we have all descendants, then we have a tree that looks like this, and we could think about fitting it. But nobody ever does this. And the reason they don't do this is because, in general, when you have a group of species, you don't have every conceivable species here, some of which may have gone extinct since the process started. But you have a subset of them, either because of extinction or because the paleontologist simply picked a group of 10 species, a set of 10 species out of those available. And here is what you would have on the same tree when I sample 10 random species. So this is that previous tree, but I stripped off all the branches. And now when you look at it, stripped off all the ones that had, that go only to species that we didn't sample. And what you find is, then it's not so clear, because here, for example, is a speciation. The new species has a burst of change. The old species has a burst of change, too. Why is that? The answer is because there are other splits going on, and in some of those, this lineage would be the new lineage. And it's descended from the original lineage, but it would be new one. So it too gets a horizontal burst of evolution. So once you take a subset of species out of a punctuated tree, it isn't so punctuated anymore. The amounts of change on different lineages are distributed not in a strictly punctuated way, but in a subsampled punctuated tree way. And this issue of doing numerical fits to punctuated processes and taking into account the subsampling of tips is looming out there for people to investigate, but it is basically, I've basically seen no literature using either the original scheme or what would happen if you take into account subsampling. Okay. I should say one more thing and then go finally to a comparative method for discrete characters. Another thing which is taken into account in the comparative methods literature that's important is also the fact that everything I was showing you, let's go back to there. Everything I was showing you was working on the assumption that we could observe the means of these of the characters in these five species. And you may say, well, sure, you can. Well, you can't actually observe what the species mean is, because for that you'd have to collect every individual in the entire species. What you can do is take a sample. And you can say, well, I've got 10 specimens of this, and I've got 2 specimens of that, and I've got 100 specimens of that one. And I'm going to estimate the character values from those. Well, when you do that, it'll immediately become clear that some of the species are represented perhaps only by a single specimen. So things that are obscure, hard to find, not much attention has been paid them, they're living in some part of the world that's difficult to get to. There will be grossly different sample sizes here. And in addition to the variation from each other that is caused by the evolution on the tree, there will be an additional variation caused by the sampling within the species. And the variance associated with that is not the variance of evolutionary change, or the covariances of evolutionary change. It's the sampling variance, and what that is, even if you think a species is just one population, which it isn't, but even if it's one population, and you sample individuals from it, it's the within species phenotypic variances and covariances that affect that. So it's a different and differently correlated set of variation that gets you an extra little burst at each tip caused by the fact that you're sampling only a limited number of specimens. I have a paper, there's a paper by Ives, Midford, and Garland in 2007, if I recall, in Evolution. This part is, by the way, not in the book, this point, because the book was written several years earlier. Ives, Midford, and Garland have a paper saying, well, if you know the within-species covariances, here's a way of correcting for that, and their way works. It's fine. I have a paper a year later saying, if you don't know the within-species covariances but are going to get it out of the same study, here's how you do that. It's a more complex machinery. It's implemented in program by me. It's hardly, in the intervening 7 years, there has hardly been any movement in other people's comparative method programs to put in some correction for that. I think that's an oversight on their part, and I think they will be moving quickly to correct for that. Up till now, people have had to more or less use my program, or if you know what the covariances are, rather than estimating them using Ives, Midford, and Garland's. Yeah.
Doesn't that also come up when you're looking at like adaptive evolution, like the various rates of synonymous versus non-synonymous changes?
It comes out. Issues like that come out in molecular phylogenies, including in the points that you're making, when we take coalescent trees of genes within species into account. It's a comparable point. We'll be getting, every time you ask a question, I tell you what's going to be on the next slide. But we will be addressing that issue. I want to show you one last thing, since we're in the last 2 minutes of the lecture. We did make it all the way with the power available in the computer. Next time I'll either have a new power cord, find the original power cord, or be sitting, borrow another computer. I'm going to skip over the two species comparison methods described in the book. But I want to just tell you about a piece of work done by Mark Pagel at the University of Reading in England. He's very well known for his work on using molecular phylogeny methods to analyze change of languages. And so people will tell you, oh, he's that guy, that English guy who works on languages has done so much on that. Actually, Mark is an American. His PhD is from the University of Washington in the animal behavior people in the psychology department. But he's in Reading now. And he basically said, let's ask whether traits that are 0 and 1 can be modeled, and we can ask about their covariation. And he did that by saying, well, you can imagine character 1 undergoes a stochastic process. He's assuming it's like a nucleotide, that 0 and 1 are like different nucleotides, and you're changing back and forth between them in a simple Markov process that has two rates, a rate for going forward and a rate for going backward. But he says, suppose that character 2 also has a Markov process, except we're going to say that when character 1 has state 0, it has one set of rates, and when character 1 has state 1, it has a different set of rates. So instead of two rates forward and backward for character 2, we get 4 of them. Furthermore, you can also say, well, maybe the same thing is happening that character two is influencing character 1. And you get, again, instead of 2 rates, you get 4. So you basically have a scheme. I'm trying to remember, did I put the whole table looks like this. Instead of having characters changing independently, he says, well, suppose that they change as two non-independent characters. In that case, there are four possible states of that double, of that pair of characters. And you make a Markov process, you imagine a sort of substitution matrix that is going from each of these four possibilities to each of those four. And if you take the rates I showed on the, those arrows and put them in, you'll find that they populate back this way with zero rate for changing both characters simultaneously. You're assuming here that each character is changing at a rate that depends on the current state of the other character, that it's going in continuous time, so there's exactly zero chance that they will both happen to change exactly simultaneously in a tiny slice of time. And what you can do is, this looks like a nucleotide substitution matrix. You can use all the regular likelihood machinery, and you can test this model, and you can get likelihoods on the tree, and you can test various restrictions of the model. If somebody says character 1 does not influence character 2, that's saying that alpha 1 equals alpha 0 equals alpha 1 here, and beta 1 equals beta 0, that's there. If you say that the character 2 does not, that character 2, which way, I can't remember which way it was, the other way, that the influence the other way, that's an assertion that the gammas are equal and that the deltas are equal. And that you can do a likelihood ratio test on. It's just you've restricted the parameters of your substitution matrix. And so Pagel's programs in 1994 did a likelihood ratio test on whether these things were equal here or whether you needed to allow character 1 to influence character 2 or character 2 to influence character 1. And it's under this assumption that the change of the 0-1 characters is nucleotide-like. That is a legitimate test. So I think that's the end of our lecture. I'm sorry I've gone on a little late, but I happen to know we don't have another class coming in, so I could go on for another hour, but I won't. We'll pick up next time. We're going to start in on coalescence. And I will get your homeworks back to you by next Wednesday.